Hi, good evening. Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny. And tonight, for 1 week only, with Rebecca Watson, who's our special guest host. She's over here on holiday, I suppose, from America. So we've decided to make her work. Rebecca leads a team of sceptical female activists at skeptic.org. And she co-hosts the weekly podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, which is, I suppose, a sort of compared to Little Atoms, but it's a very highly recommended. Her pilot radio show, Curiosity Aroused, was a winner of the 2007 Public Radio Talent Quest and has been aired on 10 public radio stations in the US. And I'm going to hand over to Rebecca, who is going to introduce our actual guest for this week, who is Tim Minchin.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm getting paid for this, right? We didn't
absolutely
discuss this beforehand. But oh, good. All right. I've already collected
which most you've already
of
had.
Those. Right. No, I'm very excited because we're here with someone who I have a lot of respect for, Tim Minchin. He's an Australian musician, actor, comedian, and writer. And he's released two live comedy albums, Dark Side and So Rock. His debut DVD, So Live, was recorded at the Sydney Opera House in May 2007. And it was released by Madman Entertainment in November of that year. And he just got finished a great big tour. And so the main thing that I'm wondering is, Tim, as a skeptical comedic rock star, how are the groupies?
Groupies are nerds mostly.
Nice.
And they're women mostly.
That's good.
And they're hot, you know, like all nerds, they're hot. Hot women. All nerds are hot women. I've got a t-shirt that says all nerds are hot women.
It's a good t-shirt.
All hot women are nerds on the back.
Oh, good one. I see what you did there.
Thanks.
You flipped it.
Yeah, I flipped it. Mm-hmm. I'm getting paid too, man. I'm on top of my game already. Yeah, no, they're good. I love them. Actually, my fans are amazing. And I when I say fans, I say it with the assumption of inverted commas because I don't really know it. That means, I think in comedy, especially in my sort of comedy, they're not like rock band fans, but they're people that come to my shows a lot and talk about my shows a lot and stuff. And I thought that everyone had fans like this, but I've realised that they don't. There's a really good community who have basically used me as an excuse to find each other, really. And they're really smart. And as I say, mostly women, not all women, but the vast majority are women. And from the ages of 15 to 50, and I've got fans who have flown to Australia to meet each other, and a couple of Americans who come over here, and they all meet up, and probably the thing that binds them all is they're smart people.
Well,
quite smart.
Yeah, I mean, did you
weird, huh?
It is weird. Well, I think all three of us are on that level where we have like the awesomest fans ever because they're. Yeah, like you said, it's like a community.
Nerd fans.
Nerd fans, and they're a lot of fun to hang out with.
Your people find you eventually.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. So you made the jump from Australia all the way out here to England. Was it difficult? Was that a difficult jump?
Well, not really, because in Australia I didn't have any. I started comedy and came here straight away, so my whole journey's been here. It's not like I left a big career in Australia and made the decision to extract myself from that and try it somewhere else. I basically came here the UK in 2005 and did a festival that went really well, and I suddenly went, oh, I could have a career if I get my shit over there, and so I did, and I seem to have a career here now, and now I'm going to come visit you guys and maybe spend a bit of time over there next year.
Yeah, you're going to conquer the US next
year. Yeah, I'm going to nail it.
Figuratively.
I've heard it's pretty. I've got to give myself a couple of weeks, pop over there, nail it, come home, I think.
Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am.
Yeah, kind totally. Of. Yeah, it's pretty easy, isn't it?
I think so.
Obama did it pretty quickly.
It's pretty much how he did it,
totally.
Can we go back to Tim? Let's go back to when you started getting into comedy then, because you're sort of quite difficult to categorise. Are you a musician that does comedy or a comedian that does music? And I've read it's quite interesting that you sort of claim never to have actually, you know, you weren't a consumer of comedy, you didn't go to comedy when you
got
into that world. So talk about that, how you went from being, you know, a musician into the
well,
comedy.
It's probably a bit disingenuous to say you're not a fan of comedy because we're so saturated in comedy stuff on telly and stuff, but I certainly had never gone to live gigs or anything, and so I'm just going to move my mic, which might make a noise because I want to see your beautiful face. Oh, look.
He's a cutie.
If you guys haven't seen Neil and you're a regular listener, just on top of the kind of sense of his charm and intelligence, you can bestow upon him an extraordinary aesthetic. He really is.
Yeah, we're a little turned on right now.
Yeah,
all
it's
of us
a bit hard to discuss. Yeah,
so I'll buy you both that
on a swivel chair. But I think I'm a musician who does comedy as opposed to the other way around. I certainly didn't ever. The other thing I didn't do was build up the way comedians generally build up, especially in America. They do their 5 minutes and then their 8 minutes and then their 10 minutes and then they learn to headline and do half an hour or, you know, and there's this sequence you go through. Because I come from more a theatre background, like doing plays, and I'm more I used to write a lot of music for theatre and act a bit in theatre, and so I just thought, oh, if you're going to do a show, it's got to be 70 minutes, you know, you can't rip people off. So I just sort of did it, you know. And at that early stage, my spoken comedy, my non-song-based comedy, was just sort of weird monologues, and I didn't really see it as stand-up. I'm having to accept this idea that what I do in between my songs now is stand-up, which is something I feel threatened by because it's a thing you fear. So, I mean, 5 years ago, if someone said you're going to do stand-up in front of people, I would have just gone, nah, sorry, mate.
But it's almost something you've had to come up with inadvertently, and in that you've obviously got to link the songs together. And if the songs are humorous, I mean, how did that?
Yeah,
sort of
I guess I just that's right. I don't have to do as much talk as I do, but I actually don't think I think I'm all right at it. You know, for someone with so little experience, I think I've found my style, and more than anything else, I've found confidence that it's okay to just do what I want. Early on when I started doing comedy over here, you get a little bit of feedback from critics and stuff that, you know, stand-up's not as good as the songs. And it just took a bit of confidence building for me to go, well, I don't actually care because my shows are a whole thing and the talk feeds into the mood I'm trying to create for the next song. And, you know, it stands. And sometimes I talk for 10 or 12 or more minutes without a song, and so I can't pretend it's just facilitating the songs, but I'm starting to realize, and actually this my kind of finding you guys, you know, this sort of I'm a little bit of a label avoider, I guess. I think we all want to be, but finding my science nerd within, and I don't mean I'm good at science or anything, but just that it suits my brain to live an empirical sort of existence, and finding a community that supports that belief system has actually been part sort of hand in hand with me finding what I feel confident in talking about on stage, like what my point of difference is, and I know there's other comedians out there doing it, but I've suddenly gone, oh, hold on, this is what interests me, you know, logic and philosophy and the universe and macro topics. And I've gone, oh, that's okay, I can talk about that, because at least that differentiates me from what a lot of comedy these days is, which is sort of the comedy of minutiae, taking tiny subjects and making them massive, the Seinfeldian kind of muffin
What's
tops.
What's up with the airplane peanuts? Yeah,
but that's brilliant, right? I get it. Yeah. I think it's brilliant. I love that you take tiny things and blow them into massive things. I suddenly went, oh, I think what I might be doing is taking big concepts and making them pathetic and human. And I think that's where a lot of... And so I'm finding the thing that is my style of comedy. And so I'm feeling more confident that I can talk about what I want and I don't have to worry about what most stand-ups do or whatever.
Well, and so with that, I mean, do you worry about making the jump to the U.S. where, you know, you're gonna piss off some people?
Yeah, the religion stuff's not going to go down as well as it does in Europe, is it? Or are you going to find more people that find that contentious?
Yeah, that's right. But the thing about the U.S. is... if you just take the 10% of Americans who are basically godless, if it's 10%,
I think we've got more than that. Actually.
You reckon? Yeah, well, I'm sure you. That, and that's,
I suspect it's much.
That's a very, very valid point. You dig them out. You know, they might not. Yeah. I'm not talking about banner waving godless. I don't care what you call yourself. But if you find the idea of religion absurd and can see how funny it is that some people think, you know, that they're right about their God, and if you can, and all that, if you can find the comedy in that, and I try to talk obliquely about this stuff and also to be very specific about my criticisms of religion stuff, because I think it's I can't, if I have to listen to another stand up sort of go, what is it with God? That's stupid. You know, it's not good enough, you know. You have to get in there. And so I'm trying to do good stuff about God because I'm aware that it can be a bit of a bore. But in what is that, 300 and something million people in America? What's the population of your great nation? You know,
I wasn't expecting that kind of question.
You didn't bone up on that.
I really didn't.
But, you know, that means there's more people in America that are my potential audience than there are in the entire of Australia, the whole population of Australia. So you've just got to find your audience. And like with my fans, your audience will find you if you say the things. But my season I did in New York last year, there's no doubt the evolution stuff that I do and things like that, it got more gasps. And I don't think it's because the people who come to my show are fundamentalist Christians or any other type. I think it's because it's more culturally, it's a gaspy, it's a big thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it might be like they're just not expecting you to go there.
Yeah, that's right. Whereas in the UK and in Australia, it's pretty much a shrug, you know.
And I think that's the problem in the US. It's not that people aren't ready to hear it, but it's that most comedians, most entertainers aren't ready to go there because they're afraid people aren't ready to. And so it seems like, you know, if you just do it, you're going to find your audience. And I suspect that you're going to find a lot of success in the US because of that.
Well, I certainly feel, certainly my little toes in the water moments in the US have brought great support and from the industry. And let's not pretend. I mean, the British are all like, oh, we're also, you know, European and we've seen it all and la la. The most cutting satire and the most anti-establishment, iconoclastic satire comes out of America. The English all go, oh, Americans don't get irony and Americans are so conservative.
Yeah,
Show me one Family Guy or South Park coming out of the UK. The UK is much more into its kind of quirky absurdism. Mm-hmm. Americans, once you've nowhere to look, are absolutely creating the most cutting-edge satire in the world. I don't think you can argue against that. So as far as I'm concerned, there's great potential. And a huge amount of emails I get from Americans going, I just discovered you on Graham Norton and BBC America, and you know, and they're really supportive. But the potential to get yourself in a bit of trouble is higher, and that's why it's exciting. Because what I think is important is that gasp that they do. That's bullshit. That is a sort of tokenistic. It's I think it might be embedded in your constitution, you know. Americans are
you have
that
to gasp.
Thing, that document, you know, like it, almost, yeah. That thing you guys all spiel when you're at school and stuff. It's the basis of it is so good that you respect other people's beliefs. But the sort of negative extension of that is that you respect nonsense, you know, and that you fail to question nonsense. And the religiosity in America is scary. It's kind of only bettered by the Middle East.
I think I always suspected that a lot of it stems from our inability to properly define the term tolerate, because we talk a lot about tolerating religion, and a lot of people misunderstand that to mean that we have to like it. But no, when I'm just barely tolerating you, you're going to know it.
Yeah, that's right. Or tolerate religion, but don't you dare bring it into my education system.
Right, by tolerating, I'm going to allow you to do whatever crazy thing you want to do. Right, but that also means that I'm going to set the boundaries.
Yeah,
and yeah, I think that a lot.
And also, of course, there's the horrible hypocrisy of the massive majority of, and I'm only talking about Americans because we're talking about America. I hope people don't think I'm, you know, I do quite a lot of material about America in my show because it's just so ripe for it. It's so obvious in America. But that's not to say these people aren't all over the world. But that hypocrisy of tolerance of religion and stuff, while religion, the dominant religions in America, are intolerant of homosexuals, you know, or intolerant of the women or intolerant of science. You know, it's just bullshit.
Yeah. No, it's a constant fight in the U.S. between teaching people their place. And, you know,
it's sort of exciting from my point of view because over here, you know, as I say, it's a pretty shruggy thing to say God's a biatch in the UK. No one It's just like, we've heard all this before, whereas in America, oh, it's nice as a comedian to have
a
little
gold,
have a
you know?
Pin that you can stick.
Right. And, and you know, it makes it ups the ante. You know, you're playing for more. You're not just
right.
making fun of stuff. You're causing change.
And potentially you're not just preaching to the choir. But
right.
Which is another big conversation, that issue of what is the goal of the bloggers and writers and comedians and artists and novelists and movie makers who have a non-religious worldview. You know, how do you make it swallowable for people who either have a religious worldview or are on the fence?
So then you're right. You can either be aiming this stuff at an audience that that's going to tolerate that, or you know, and just ignore the rest, or you can water it down to appeal to a mass audience.
Well, I don't know if you always have to compromise, because I think what matters is being realistic about where you sit. You know, your new prez, right? I don't believe he's a very religious person. His job is to be extremely careful, to toe the line, to talk about God because it's what Americans expect. And yet, even in his inauguration, he said non-believers, which I've never heard from an American leader ever, as a group.
Yeah,
which was quite,
And you gave a shout out to science as well.
Gave a shout out to science,
hopeful, isn't it?
But then
science.
Right. Yeah, no, all the science nerds in the audience were definitely like, yeah.
Yeah, and then they edited the gay priest out of the.
You're right. And then he ended with, you know, God bless us. God
I know,
bless
and I find that the weirdest thing, right?
Yeah.
Coming from Australia and living in England, it spooks me out that they all sit there talking as if God cares about America. It's a very strange and difficult thing for me to handle, that everyone doesn't just burst out laughing when someone says that.
Yeah.
They should. That's the right reaction.
Yeah.
When someone stands there like that, the preacher they did leave on, the anti-gay preacher that they left on the telly.
Yeah. Rick Warren.
Rick Warren, mm-hmm. the super
who
preacher.
Who wrote Purpose-Driven Life and hates the gays.
He hates the gays. And he's... you know, like, he's a good speaker, I get it. But when he was saying all that stuff, I'm just like, oh, come on, guys. Why aren't 2 million people in that mall having a giggle at this?
Yeah.
I bet 500,000 were, or 200,000, I hope so. But I guess what I was thinking is, Obama, let's say that someone like the president is not very religious. His job is to chip away at the very edges of religiosity to go, hold on, gay people aren't so bad, and let's get back stem cell research, and let's make sure that education has a strict guideline that we use knowledge in education, not mythology, and teach mythology, and that sort of stuff. That's his job, right? For maybe a blogger or a writer, you know, maybe someone else can be a bit more conservative. Someone like me, I'm going to come out and say, religion's wrong, evolution's right. You know, if you hate gay people, you are an asshole. You know, I'm going to just do that. So it begs the question, well, what the hell am I doing preaching to my own atheistic choir, you know, up in my godless choir stalls? But I feel all right about that, because what I think is important is that at the other end of your president being conservative and careful, there's people radicalizing the people who are almost already there, especially young people.
Yeah.
And in comedy and music, your audience is largely young. And I'm not saying I'm out there to change the world. I'm just out there to talk about my stuff, earn some money and do some funny songs, right? But I have to admit, now my audience is getting a bit bigger, that there is an element of influence. So I see my job as being to get those kids who are like, surely this is bollocks, to help them go across the line, you know.
Yeah.
Lewis, we're being quite serious and a little preachy.
I'm always serious on interview.
What we always serious. Do, and I think I want to talk about a particular aspect of some of your songs, which I really love about them, is the way that you, and I hope I've not completely misread this, because it'll be really embarrassing if I have.
But all the pro-Jesus stuff, we really like that.
Yeah, that's right.
I love the way that you certain songs, and I'm thinking particularly here, the one example I'm going to think of first of all is Canvas Bags, right?
Yeah.
Which is a you know, it's a really serious subject and a great sentiment where you're basically just saying don't buy plastic bags,
and I'm
buy
saying
canvas
over
bags.
And over and over
exactly
again.
And you just repeat the same line over and over again, and it's a perfectly great idea, but you do it in this way that basically at the same time sort of punctures the very idea of a pop star doing this thing via the medium of a song, which I think is just brilliant. And then to take that a bit further, even more so, is the peace anthem for Palestine one, which it's just
it's getting a lot of hate mail online at the moment.
It's incredible because it works on so many levels. Not only are you saying, you know, it's a song about Israel and Palestine, which only has four lines, which basically says, you know, on the one hand, you know, come on, guys, this is ridiculous. It's easy to sort this out. On the other hand, it's saying, you know, it's underlining the ridiculousness of writing a peace anthem to solve something. It's also an incredibly beautiful piece of music. You know, it's...
You're my perfect audience. You're picking up everything. Yeah, I mean, I don't... You know, when you're writing a show, there are times when you want your intent to be very clear, and there's times when you want to be a bit ambiguous. And always I try and make it musically interesting, because I think that adds to the comedy and stuff. Because if it's actually beautiful, people are sort of... It just clashes so much.
Yeah, it makes it even funnier. Yeah. It's even funnier.
But, I mean, my intent, of course, the jumping-off point for that song is like... Okay, so this is this tiny place in the world where these people kill each other, and the only difference between your two religions is a person with epilepsy 600 years ago doing an edit. It's the same religion. You have the same customs. You both don't eat pigs. You both get your foreskins cut off. You both cover the heads of your women. It's the same religion, and you're killing each other. Of course, the conflict there now is nothing to do, as I say in the intro of that song, mostly it's actually nothing to do with the doctrine. It's to do with everything that's gone on since. But I've had people criticize that song, saying, you know, you are trying to make this conflict about religion and about religious doctrine and the clashing of two religious doctrines, but it's not about that. It's about this abuse and that abuse. And I can't help but think you're extremely naive to try and claim that it's not at its root about that. I mean, there's no way. Put it this way. If none of them had a book that they thought was special, they wouldn't be fighting over that bit of dirt.
Yeah,
they wouldn't have stuck them there in the first place, in the 40s or whatever it was.
I don't know if you guys have it here, but in the U.S. we have the story of the Hatfields and the McCoys, and they're two families that hate each other, and, you know, they go centuries, and, you know, the kids are still fighting with each other, but they get to the point where they don't really know why. But if you ask them why, they'll come up with all kinds of excuses for why, but when really it started, you know, several centuries ago over, you know, something kind of silly.
And I guess all human conflicts like that, you know, generally there's... The most recent reason is not the origin.
Right.
The most recent reason is retribution, nearly always.
Yeah.
You just cross. And that's very human nature. That's the same as any relationship, any marriage.
Can I just point out that Neil started that track by trying to lighten things up?
Yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
You failed.
So, yes.
Over and over again, journos.
All right, okay, well, let's have another go.
We're
quickly running out of time, so...
I told you I'd talk too much.
Yeah, I was going to raise
Speaking of your songs... I have a special surprise for you. I wrote you a song.
Jesus.
Can you do you mind hearing it and letting me know what you think?
Okay, I will give you
Neil
honest
Neil hasn't
notes.
Heard this either, so this is like a total surprise. Okay.
All right.
I'm just going to kind of read
you're
it.
You're going to sing
you know?
It?
I don't think I can. I've got that cold still, so.
Okay, sure. Otherwise,
you okay. Drum. We could.
We do have a drum, but I don't have a guitar. Here we go. Ready?
I don't know who this is going to be more embarrassing for.
You're going to like it, I think.
Okay.
All right, let me know. All right, ready? Your love for me is not just marginal. You find my nether regions forageable.
Forageable?
Your extra parts make you enlargeable, massageable, rechargeable you.
Oh, wait. I see where this is going.
You came from Asia because you're bargeable. But I didn't feel I was overcharged at all. You're always there when I'm lethargical, remarkable, rechargeable you. I wrote a bridge.
This is
hold on.
So good.
With you in my hands, I get tingly with all kinds of joys. We have fun all night, though the neighbors complain about the noise. Stealing batteries from remotes is now just a thing of the past. My energy crises are gone because by Christ he's rechargeable, so he'll continue to last.
Oh, that's so good.
You're very tidy. There's no discharge at all. Because I paid extra, you're submergible.
Submergible.
When others visit, you're so storageable, engorgeable, rechargeable you.
That's amazing. I feel a little bit threatened on two
Anybody
levels.
That's not familiar with Tim's oeuvre might not have. I'm sorry, that last section was a little self-indulgent. But get on YouTube and look up
Inflatable. Look up that was inspired by Inflatable You. I thought that there.
You've taken it to a new level. I feel threatened as a songwriter and as a man.
I thought that the girls needed a version.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a virgin. We've got 3 minutes. What are we going to do?
Are we
Neil?
Done?
We've got 3 minutes for the...
Okay, good. I've got another song. No. I don't.
Yeah, sorry. I've not finished mine, so unfortunately we'll have to wait that for the next time for me to pull out my...
Next time, yeah.
You can send it
Maybe
to
next time we'll
MP3.
Have a little concert. We'll have instruments and everything.
Totally. Yeah. Tribute band.
Tim, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tim.
I know I'm not funny, but... Yeah.
Don't say that. That's not going to sell you tickets.
Yeah. Oh no, I'm funny when I'm not here.
And Rebecca, thanks as well for taking time out of your.
I wasn't doing anything.
I'm pretty excited about being on a podcast with you. I listen to you a lot.
Well, I listen to you a lot.
I actually listen to Steve.
Well, screw you.
But you seem to be quite fun too.
Thanks, guys. Nobody listens to us. Good night, and we'll see you next time. Thanks.